Welcome to an episode of Constructing the Real. This is Lucia from Art and Labor, and I am here to read through a text that I find very helpful in terms of, trying to figure out where to make art from. This is a book. That is for sure. It's called Art and Bear Life. It's by Josephine Berry. And the theory that she builds upon is structured around Foucault's theses around, the way that our culture is a little bit of a piece of shit prison, and madness is a construct of civilization, and all that good stuff that you've probably encountered in undergrad. But her book is really cool because she relates everything to art movements that occur simultaneously to the theory. So that's one of the reasons why I found this reading so inspiring, and why I wanted to share it with the audience, because I know that there are a lot of people who are creatives and they're trying to figure out what the fuck they're supposed to do while society is collapsing. And a lot of people are going to tell you that you're probably supposed to just make a big old propaganda poster for whoever your political affiliates are. And that's cool. I do that sometimes, but that's not all that art can be or all that art is. So even though we're in the midst of a earth-shattering pandemic, we can take this in stride along with everything else. And, find out where our creativity is really coming from in a way that is genuine for each person who is experiencing that drive. So without further ado, I'm going to read the introduction to Art and Bear Life. The title is Art in the Age of Biopower. Biopower is a term that is going to be defined through the introduction. So without further ado, here we go. Relating theories of biopower to those of modern art is an asymmetric endeavor. Despite its current popularity, the concept of biopower was first developed by Michel Foucault as recently as 1976 to describe an order of power that grasps life itself as its object of intervention. The history of modern art, by contrast, is one that has been told for the better part of two centuries. However, when we start to explore the fundamentally new ways in which modern systems of biopower act on human life to sacralize, organize, specify, modify, and profit from it, it becomes clear that this development has everything to do with the emergence of modern art, whose guiding logic is also to assimilate and affect life. And here we know, of course, Art and Labor listeners are familiar with the fact that world governments have affected modern art on the Soviet and the US side, and everywhere in between. Modern art is incredibly politically based. Biopower is not another neologism that attempts to define capitalism's current commodification of the flesh, anything from, gene splicing to Botox injections. But one of the indispensable elements in the expansion of capitalism that is reflected in the development of art at its core. Biopower takes advantage of the abundance of life created by modern productive techniques and technologies and seeks to direct its surplus toward the interests of the capitalist state. Now, this means, like, even your, you know, commie memes, you know, everything. Foucault attributed the recession of death in the 18th century primarily to advances in modern agriculture and the reduction of epidemics, sketching the wide scope of their impact. Western man has gradually learned that what it meant to be a living species in a living world, to have a body, conditions of existence, probabilities of life, an individual and collective welfare, forces that could be modified, and a space in which they could be distributed in an optimal manner. For the first time in history, no doubt, biological existence was reflected in political existence. This leap forward in the apparent ability to collectively determine human welfare helped to precipitate a new democratic order of power that placed the value of human life at its center. The repositioning of biological or naked life at the fulcrum of politics and economics brought into administrative and scientific view the determining conditions of the world upon the living, opening them up to new knowledge and interventions on a grand scale. This imbrication of politics and life itself was what Giorgio Agamben later called bare life, the entry of Zoe into the sphere of polis. The politicization of bare life as such constitutes the decisive event of modernity. The appearance of the material conditions of life as an object of reason liberated European thought from the opaque fatalism of a divine order and unleashed the empowering prospect of human self-determination. It was a prospect that, with all the opportunities and uncertainties this entailed, began to overwhelm the traditional models of sovereignty as such as the ritual and social functions of art. As the monarchies that had cemented rigid social hierarchies began to crumble under the pressure of the Enlightenment, art was progressively freed from its ritual function and aesthetic conventions to become a freely self-determining entity. We know this state of perilous freedom as l'art pour l'art. And now you're getting up to, you know, Andy Warhol bullshit. But before that, you know, you were starting out in France there, maybe, you know, all over Europe with the Enlightenment. But the modern state's elevation of the life of its population resulted in increased interference, a growing political intercession into life that had, until then, been restricted to the imposition of death or banishment. A new relationship between bare life and the state was created. One that politicized the body to foster multiply and put this life in order. It should be noted that while for Foucault this capturing of life is entirely contingent upon modern democratic and scientific thinking, Agamben diverges in this, positing Zoe, the life common to all living creatures, as the always occluded basis of politics. The inclusion of bare life in the political realm, he writes, constitutes the original, if concealed, nucleus of sovereign power. Agamben's point that creaturely life, Zoe, is included through exclusion from the political sphere until the late 18th century, while only decisions over forms of life, or bios, had previously been deliberated there, is different to Foucault's work. While Foucault consistently rejected the notion of what Sven Olav Wallenstein calls an ultimate foundation of the social order, such as Agamben's trans-historical conception of excluded Zoe as the basis of sovereignty, the two thinkers certainly concur that life's explicit inclusion into politics inaugurates modern sovereignty and its governmental and economic techniques. And here, of course, I'm just going to take a break and say that Agamben has recently come out as a non-believer in the pandemic that we're currently existing through, which has been terrible to see, but it also falls in line with his politics because he's ultimately interested in building a freedom, I think, for the you know, political constituent who starts out with a bare life and can then build an agency on that identity. But, you know, he kind of is canceled at this current time because he thinks that the media is to blame for the panic over the pandemic. Anyway, here we go. Crucially, both thinkers also agree on the significance of life's politicization as essential to the success of capitalism's own development. The political elevation of life within democracy has driven the creation of an abundant labor force for capitalism, as well as establishing the thresholds for its inclusion, exclusion, and stratification. In this way, the life that had been the private concern of the individual and God became self-alienated as the concern of the state. We can also say that modern art's defining autonomy is based in a parallel separation from common experience, meaning, and use. Yet this separation also elevated art above custom and convention, driving its incessant inventiveness and sparking its unquenchable desire to return to the thick of life. Alan Caprow, the 1950s inventor of happenings, called this trajectory the blurring of art and life. Therefore, we can identify an overt relationship between the modern state's pursuit of life and art's desire to fuse with everyday life as a strategy to overcome its newfound alienation in modernity. Rather than reading these two tendencies in parallel to one another, I argue that they are mutually affecting dynamics whose entanglement reaches a peak in the contemporary logic of the cultural industries and the creative city, an economic logic that solicits art and culture precisely for their life-affecting characteristics as well as their capacity to boost gross domestic product through the promotion of cultural tourism, innovation, inward investment, and commodity differentiation. Now, of course, this is something that we've talked about also on Art and Labor, where you see all of the trends towards gentrification. Well, and it never ends. The neoliberal adoption of the term creative to describe uncreative policies aimed at commodifying culture, cities, and education, which in turn drives up real estate values in areas of urban regeneration, is not only an effect of capitalism's profits crisis, but it reflects the wider tension of capitalist democracies that venerate life's most defining quality, its autonomous power to generate the new, while attempting to standardize, normalize, and commodify this potential. In other words, the neoliberal state's attempt to commodify and marketize creativity should be seen as continuous with its biopolitical attempt to shape and direct the life of its population. Life, after all, is the source of all market values, whether that is surplus value, social, or cultural capital, because it alone generates novelty and freedom understood materially energetically, and conceptually. Without the intercession of life, reified as labor power, material resources could not be converted into commodities, nor those commodities be consumed. Surplus value could not be created, nor could the innovation of new social and economic ideas, practices, and fashions that propel the economy evolve. As Henry Bergson once argued, life's main aim is to convert the main source of energy, the sun, into explosions of free action. Owing to this high levels of intelligence and dexterity, he claimed the human species is most able to convert sources of energy into free, undetermined action. Indeed, even in Plato's time, entities considered to have souls, that is, living creatures, were defined as those with self-generating motion, or in the Greek terminology, arche kineseos. To be autokinetic in the widest sense, self-moving, self-regulating, self-directing, is to live, to be alive. Biopower not only establishes life's ability to generate power as the ultimate source of value, it also seeks to harness this value through techniques and technologies of standardization and governance, e.g. the biotech industry. As a result, life's arche kinesos is not just redirected, but also endangered. People's freedom of geographical movement is controlled by state immigration regimes. Medical institutions determine the norms against which bodies are shaped. The cities of industrial capitalism mobilize bodies and organize life for maximum productivity. Gene splicing images the total utility of the organism. And creativity is funneled toward profit. Each process jeopardizes the living autonomy upon which the system feeds. However, art's desire to take hold of life often negotiates this antinomy between autonomy and control from the opposite direction. In attempts to overcome the separation caused by its exceptional status, modern art critically exposes the conditions of its autonomy. It extends itself by self-negation, incrementally admitting what was formerly outside it. I mean, that's like still a far-out concept, just in terms of the way that we develop culture, that we could have a medium that is so self-aware and that encapsulates all other mediums, like, forward, you know, modern art, perhaps starting, you know, with the break from the church, even, something to think about in the terms of the history of human consciousness. John Cage's concert piece, 4 minutes and 33 seconds in 1952, in which the pianist sits silently, he sits silently at the piano, compelling the audience to listen to silence, or rather the sounds it makes while waiting for the performance to begin, gives us a concise image of this. By thwarting the audience's expectation to hear music, the deliberate organization of sound, the noises of the body and its environment, coughs and scraping chairs, become the prompts of attentive and sensuous listening. Art renews itself by projecting outward into the living world around it, expanding its power by assimilating anything and everything, and so rendering all of life available to art. In taking into itself the world's uncontrollable dynamics, it reverses the biopolitical dream of mastering life while reflecting biopower's elevation of life at its core. By making life appear within its own autonomous sphere, art converts living qualities and activities into sensuous concepts that reveal the world anew. Or, ultimately, I would say it alienates people, generally, if you're walking through Chelsea. But in a very positive way, it makes the world anew. In this way, art creates new surfaces of intelligibility, truth, affect, and action within the living world, ones that suggest ways to resist biopower while also creating means through which the latter extends itself. And there's where you get the catch-22. As an effect of modernity's conversion of life into autonomous value, together with its general orientation toward the new, artists defined by their activity of poiesis, through which what is produced enters into presence, have developed an exceptional social status. Artists in modernity and postmodernity, with their putative, unconventional lifestyles and defining experimentalism, represent the individuality that capitalism claims to prize and reward. Yet, as per Andy Warhol's incisive formulation, those who talk about individuality the most are the ones who most object to deviation. For all its hype of individual creativity, capitalism tends to create repetitive and standardized structures and logics through which to organize the living and to extract profit. But it needs the myth of individuality to act as a lure to expanded forms of consumption and the conformist pursuit of self-development, a work on the self whose compliance with the requirements of capitalism is valued in terms of the appreciation or depreciation of human capital. Biopower's uncanny use of art's practice of freedom to drive competitive nationalism, conformity, and consumption, from the use of art in the French Republic in the 1970s, 1790s, a little bit farther back there, to the Festival of Britain in 1951, to current Olympic mega spectacles, to the new diversions of the culture society, has helped to undermine art's very idea of itself, and gradually the entire notion of originality and autonomy. Warhol famously claimed to want to be a machine, and used superstardom to create the blank parody of individuality, while Jackson Pollock declared, "I am nature," subsuming his personal creativity into the ego-eclipsing power of nature. Which is super fucking bizarre, because Pollock now is the CIA, so maybe the CIA is nature. And, you know, Warhol is pretty well understood to be a kind of a, you know, manipulative person who fueled a lot of other artists' drug addictions, kind of like a machine would do. So it is interesting the way that these artists, you know, replicate the state and capital, but we've been through that. And, you know, it's interesting to wonder how our creativity is replicating a structure today, and what the structure is as capitalism is seeing its present demise. Thus, by the 1950s and 60s, at the peak of the post-war consumer boom, modern art's self-negating movement, which had previously been organized around the negation of representation, shifted into a negation of individual creativity. As creativity became the most exemplary activity of the organizing powers, to adopt T.J. Clark's phrase, it also became the most suspect and endangered for art. This suspicion inaugurates two key tendencies of neo-avant-garde art: the exposure of the contrived economic and material conditions of art, conceptual, minimalist, site-specific art, and institutional critique, and the redistribution of creativity, participatory, process-based, relational, and socially engaged art. Art and Bare Life traces the arc of artistic autonomy's inception, flourishing, and deconstruction against a biopolitical horizon that has remained largely elusive or fragmentary in histories of modern and contemporary art. Of primary interest, however, is our contemporary moment and the dialectic that exists between art's attempts to produce new sensuous concepts by opening itself to lifelike forms of external determination, and the uncanny way in which this renders art a key terrain for the extension of neoliberal power. From the recalibration of the post-Fordist economy, to the regeneration of cities, to third-way social inclusion programs, to the progression of national culture as an international tool of soft power, to the cultivation of new forms of public experience, taste, consumption, and conduct, art has become an optimal tool for capitalist state power. While there is no shortage of monuments and orchestrated spectacles, art that distributes creativity to external collective, aleatory, or lifelike dynamics has nevertheless become the signature style of art in the public sphere, a diffusional form that not only mirrors the ubiquitous life-capturing nature of biopower, but the wish of modern democracies for power to appear shared. Now, this appearance of shared power is going to be very interesting at a time when we see that, our administration is pushing through a lot of legislation to cut itself its own slush funds and basically operate as it will, how art is going to contend with that is going to be an extremely interesting unknown variable. So this next section, troubling the man form. To say that art and politics are not only increasingly oriented toward life, but also behave in a more lifelike fashion, might seem to open them to determinist readings of the social Darwinist variety. The biopolitical theory of the Foucauldian tradition and its application to culture needs to be distinguished from a socio-biological one, a worldview whose crude reductionism and wish to naturalize existent political and social orders has led to atrocities we are incapable of forgetting or erasing. Biopolitical theorist Thomas Lemke pinpoints the methodological paradox of this resilient school of thought in his dismissal of a 1960s U.S. brand of political science, also now known as biopolitics, that attempted a naturalistic study of politics according to its biological causes, namely competition, cooperation, dominance, and fear of foreigners. Lemke writes, "In starting from the idea that nature is an autonomous system in a closed sphere, with the conviction that this closed sphere decisively shapes political action, biopoliticians put forward and prolong the very dualism of nature and society, whose continuing existence they also bemoan. By contrast, one of the key insights of biopolitics is the recognition that the post-sovereign decision over bare life serves as a fundamental definition of what modern politics is and determines how we construct, normalize, and experience these same embodied lives upon which power recursively acts. As the circularity of this dynamic demonstrates, in place of any definable boundary between the natural and the social, we find instead a self-affecting system that repels all dichotomizations. Thus, we must problematize Agamben's trans-historically static concept of bare life as compromising the contrast, yet hidden nucleus of power by stating, with Foucault and his teacher Georges Canguilhem, that life is a polemical, not an ontological concept. In other words, life emerges in dynamic interaction with the conditions and qualities it exists within. Now, of course, blah, 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 that's a materialist understanding of reality. But in philosophy, you know, it's not so easy to simply rely on an economic thinker for the entirety of your moral framework, as we realize in the construction of capitalism. Nevertheless, we can say that the birth of biopower marks, if not the moment when power starts to affect life, since according to the above definition, it logically always must have, albeit not strategically, then the moment at which it starts to do so positively, according to certain requirements, which are fundamentally economic and normative, and according to an understanding of life as an open, hence malleable process. Biopower, writes Foucault, has a positive influence on life that endeavors to administer, optimize, and multiply it, subjecting it to precise controls and comprehensive regulations. In this way, biopower, the conversion of life into a source of value and site of control, is accompanied by the birth of biopolitics, which is the ensemble of coordinating techniques, technologies, institutions, forms of knowledge, and social relations that extract a surplus from life and harness it for certain ends. Foucault famously formulates this transformation of politics as it takes on the biological life that had previously been excluded from its sphere of calculation and action in the following way. For millennia, man remained what he was for Aristotle, a living animal with the additional capacity for a political existence. Modern man is an animal whose politics places his existence as a living being in question. Without implying that biopower has gained any definitive control over life, or that biological processes have become subordinate to social and economic designs, Foucauldian biopolitical theory effectively dismantles social Darwinist arguments by revealing the ramifying field of relations, effects, and affects between living political, social, and epistemological systems. This is what Franz Fanon called sociogeny, a term he insisted was crucial to supplement the biological notion of phylogeny and the psychoanalytic question of ontogeny. If today we live in a world full of unpredictable threats, such as climate change, aircraft-borne Ebola outbreaks on our doorsteps, or lethal bacterial superbugs arising from the overuse of antibiotics, or hell, I mean, whatever we're going through now, we are socially and politically defined according to our biology as never before, i.e. through race, gender, sexuality, citizenship, medical ethics, biometrics, health insurance, access to welfare, etc. Yet what remains uncertain is our understanding of living systems, how they might behave or how to control them. Life's resistance to being converted into an object for power reveals how life is always external to the system that would control it. As Maurizio Lazzarato puts it, biopower coordinates and targets a power that does not properly belong to it, that comes from the outside. Biopower is always born of something other than itself. If this indeterminacy of life leaves room for manipulation by power, it also opens up the possibility of producing alternative biopolitical realities. This is what Gilles Deleuze refers to in his book on Foucault. It is in man himself that we must liberate life, since man himself is a form of imprisonment for man. Life becomes resistance to power when power takes life as its object. When power becomes biopower, resistance becomes the power of life, a vital power that cannot be confined within species, environment, or the paths of a particular diagram. Deleuze's insight is central to my book and to the decision to develop a biopolitical analysis of modern and contemporary art, since not only does progressive art aim to blur life, and thereby risk biopolitical assimilation, but its modernist constitution of admitting the external and of engaging contingency means that it constantly challenges and reinvents embodied experience as a condition of its very right to exist. Art challenges the normative construction of life, from the romantic desire to render inner life as the external object of collective experience, to the impressionist creation of ephemeral effects of life, perspective, and movement, to the post-structuralist discovery of the death of the author and birth of the reader, to the exposure of the libidinal body that underpins art's transcendental procedures in performance art, to minimalist and installation art's inclusion of the viewer's physical presence into the expanded sight of art, to art's more recent social engagement, modern and contemporary art's redistribution of the sensible, has everywhere converted Kant's disinterested spectator into a living one. The failure of these aesthetic redistributions to definitively overcome art's alienation from life and divert biopower's imperative to change life to emancipatory ends is demonstrated by the persistence of art's autonomy, its separation from the everyday within capitalism. And boy, oh, can you see that autonomy working now? It's as if the entire art world is untouched by the things that are happening around it. But eventually, I'm sure life will bleed in to interesting effect. But if art remains suspended between a return to everyday life and its stalled emancipation of life,
forever risking co-optation, its persistent troubling of the man form, as Nietzsche called it, nevertheless constitutes one of the key laboratories of resistance to biopower within capitalism. Art's ongoing attempt to distribute aesthesis, or sensuous perception, away from the omnipotent control of the author, provides an essential resource of resistance to biopower and its attempted collapse of life's infinite interrelationships into propertied individualism. In this respect, if art is unable to change life in any socially totalistic sense, it is constantly challenging the experience of what it means to be captured as living beings within a living world. By experimenting with forms and relations of life outside the norms of biopower, the best art resists power over life by redistributing our sensuous, conceptual, and aesthetic experience of it. But art's transformation of the man form bears comparison with those brought about by advances in scientific fields such as pharmacology, cloning, gene therapy, regenerative medicine, and hormonal treatments that are also busy producing new kinds of embodiment beyond any fixed plan. How then does biotechnology's drastic reinvention of the human animal and the biosphere more generally relate to art's operations upon living subjects, and where does vital resistance lie within the spectrum? Beatriz, now Paul B. Preciado, has written that it is possible to sketch out a new cartography of the transformations in industrial production during the previous century using, as an axis, the political and technical management of the body, sex, and identity. In other words, the apparent open-endedness of techno-capitalism's production of new bodies and life forms, within which we become subject to accelerating morphological, affective, sexual, temporal, biochemical, interspecial, and phantasmatic mutations, is simultaneously legible as a cartography of power. Capitalism's intensification of productive forces may be melting the man form along with all other life forms, but the chimeras it produces accord with its own developments and criteria. So, for example, the wartime economy of World War II and the Cold War space race gave rise to the most prolific period in the development of technologies of sex and gender, as large tranches of state military funding aimed at treating wounded, maimed, or fragile bodies spilled out into the consumer space. We must insist, therefore, and in opposition to bio art of the sort typified by Eduardo Kac's Fluorescent Green Rabbit, that the mutation of the body is not per se biopolitically resistant or radical, a fact that seems to be strangely lost in Preciado as she splices biopolitical theory with an account of her self-dosage with testosterone gel within a narrowly individual paradigm of transgressive transformation. If biotechnology can be said to provide a cartography of power, or a way of mapping capitalism through its inscription on the body, the 20th and 21st centuries provide numerous examples of artworks that court life as a force that Theodore Adorno called the amorphous in order to resist such capture. By requiring stable and identifiable biological norms to act as the reciprocal other of power's exertion of force and control, biopower imminently provokes a tactic of amorphous evasiveness
as its aesthetic response. In this development, we see T.J. Clark's Dross of Contingency, whose admission into art he claims inaugurates modernity elevated to the highest aesthetic good. The art of modernity is rife with techniques that seek a balancing point between what Jacques Rancière calls free appearance, the courting of unintended experiences and effects, and conscious intention, such as surrealism's automatic techniques, dreams, walks, automatisms, and games of chance. Paul Klee's Talking a Line for a Walk, Pollock's Drip Paintings, or the collective improvising of Fluxus, Situationism, and Happenings, or the emergent effects of instructional art. But equally, we can think of more determinate engagements with the contingency of naturo-artificial systems in cybernetics-inspired worlds, like Hans Hacke's Condensation Cube from 1963 to 1965, and MoMA Pole from 1970, or Jane Prophet's AI multi-user world Technosphere from 1995, or Net artist Heath Bunting's feedback experiments with the joints between virtual and physical worlds like Project X from 1996, or A Worldwide Watch, Closed Circuit Television, CCTV from 1997. Modern and contemporary art's subversion of the reconciled unity of class art by way of amorphousness entails the eruption of the artworks excluded outside within the work, a movement of self-negation that drives it forward. Of importance to our analysis of biopower and modernism is the way this self-negation continuously dilates the scope, site, and form of art, exposing the conditions of the artwork's material necessity and the viewer's embodiment that pierce and then overwhelm its ideal form. The separated world of artistic illusion is invaded by material, enunciative, and semantic bodies that are no longer stable but lively and autokinetic. For Adorno, the discrediting of classical art or art beauty that this implies corresponds to classicism's false reconciliation of the barbarous, irreconcilable noise of the world into the artwork's particularity or semblance. Adolf Hitler's Germany epitomized this distorting effect of classical beauty in its most darkly ironic form. The more torture went on in the basement, wrote Adorno, the more insistently they made sure that the roof rested on columns. The eruption of the ugly, noisy, and amorphous within the avant-garde turned the living substrate targeted by biopolitical capitalism into the agent of dissent. For Adorno, this was a revolt against mendacious beauty in the name of a beauty not yet realized by human society. Adorno saw this dialectic alluded to in Charles Baudelaire's phrase, spleen and ideal, used as the title of a section from his poem cycle, The Flowers of Evil. Back of the world, spleen is the obsession with what resists being formed, with the transformation of what is hostile to art into art's own agent, which thus extend art's concept beyond that of the ideal. But it is also through semblance, this conversion of experience into autonomous objectivity, that Adorno understood art as the risk of becoming mere fact, annulled and assimilated into use. I think that kind of ends up being a lot of our resistance statements
if I could be so blunt. They become mere fact and they can be marketed back to us. While art's revolt against semblance is intimately related to its revolt against providing power with the stable idealizations it requires, Adorno also saw amorphousness as threatening art's defining quality of semblance. Its purposively purposeless power to take control of its own unity, its meaning and difference from external reality. This danger has, I think, only grown since the 1960s when he wrote Aesthetic Theory, because the dialectic of self-negation swallows up art's outside, whose determining force it struggles to distinguish itself from. While its unimpeachable autonomy serves as an alibi for instrumentalization by those same extraneous forces. Baudelaire's choice of the word spleen is apt because it denotes a visceral organ as well as humor or mood. In 19th century France, splenétique meant a state of melancholy or pensive sadness. If classical aesthetics sublimated affect within the artwork so that even horrific acts could be coolly contemplated via art's mediating prisms, for example, Matteo di Giovanni's Massacre of the Innocents, painted for a church in Siena in 1482, converts slaughtered into a frieze of rapture, and reformed real bodies behind the veil of ideal beauty, autonomous art ruptures the spleen of affect to hijack the neutral space of spectatorship. This effective revolt is a crucial aspect of the amorphousness Adorno refers to, as well as art's biopolitical engagement with bare life, enlisting the full amplitude of the viewer's emotional, corporeal, and sensorial capacities in an expanded experience of the work. In modern and contemporary art, affect is no longer kept at one stage removed within the artwork's internal economy, but ricochets across bodies and beyond artistic control, spilling into the real space of the viewer. There is little we can do to prevent our spontaneous physical revulsion when viewing films of self-mutilation by the 1960s Viennese actionists. In this way, according to Ranciere, what is most free in what he terms the aesthetic regime of art is not art itself, but experience. The free appearance in the artwork of what is not art, because it is not willed, becomes the basis of its autonomy, self-regulation, that lies paradoxically outside itself. This pursuit of heteronomy leads, of course, to the proliferation of the participatory art that has become the hegemonic form of our times. In Ranciere's words, the artwork participates in the sensorium of autonomy in as much as it is not a work of art. Now, I would beg everybody to think about the way that Pace is trying to vanguard the pivot towards experiential artworks and ways that they can profit off of that, regardless of the fact that a lot of their workers who were freelance were just let go, and their experience, while it can't be deemed art, is definitely deemed valuable and deemed something that is barred from the participation in art. It's pretty interesting, I guess. But we all know that. This produces what remains the central quandary of our contemporary art. How, as Adorno once asked, can making
bring into appearance what is not the result of making. I will explore how art's paradoxical desire for what is outside of itself leads to its expansion into all areas of life and thereby coincides with biopolitical capitalism's subsumption of life in the most expanded sense. As Michael Feher has demonstrated in the field of political theory, the erstwhile free labor of Fordism had been conceptually and practically split between a sovereign self who undertook biological, social, cultural, and moral reproduction, and the part of the self that could be commodified as labor power and exchanged for money. With the advent of neoliberalism, we see the rise of human capital as a dominant subjective form. That does not presuppose any separation between the spheres of reproduction and production. In this economic and subjective transition, the sovereignty of reproductive life, the part of life not directly exchanged for the wage, as socialist feminists are familiar with, poking around in this field of care, is abolished and entirely opened to the value form. Within this, there is a conspicuously convergent relationship between art's quest to liberate life as aesthetic praxis, to change life, and the regulative and aesthetic control of life inherent within capitalism's subsumption of reproduction. The impetus toward undetermined experience that forms Rancière's model of political aesthetics, impelling its expansion into the everyday, is easily co-opted by the aesthetic reform of life that lies at the core of biopower's action upon the self-activity of subjects, guided as it is by the triage of economics. So, for example, being well-educated, fit, and healthy are deemed more desirable because they are more economically valorizable than being uneducated and unwell. Take note, homies, in this day of unwellness. This disturbing coincidence of one's radical aesthetics and biopower can be further understood through their mutual conversion of life into an autonomous value, where autonomous art is licensed to image life beyond the demands of necessity or converts necessary into art. Rearcrit Taravanija's decision to cook in the gallery as instead of making art. Biopower harnesses aesthetics to transform the activity of the body's reproduction into a necessarily profit-oriented keyhole of affect, control, and commodification. I would say holding up Rearcrit as an example is a little bit awkward, as the last time that he had his cooking in a gallery, I'm pretty sure only celebrities and art people were allowed, and certainly no people who could have used the meal. Anyway, theaters of contingency and control. A critical dimension of the discovery of life as an autonomous value was the discovery of population at the end of the 18th century, a conceptual shift from the pastoral of souls to the political government of men, in which government begins to aggregate individuals into the mass object of calculated interventions in the name of national well-being. No longer God's subjects or ethical subjects or mere demographic data, the term population expresses the conceptual insertion of human beings into their environments in distinctly biological terms. This crucial aspect of population thinking is for Foucault correlated with the emergence of the schema of the milieu, put forward by early biologist Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. The burgeoning discipline of life science was starting to reveal deep connections between organisms and their environment, breaking down understandings of creaturely sovereignty and grasping organisms in an evolutionary feedback loop with their material circumstances. Implicit in this development was the understanding of milieus or environments as more or less beneficial for organisms, as well as the notion of an organism's reciprocal relationship with its environment. The biological basis for population thinking therefore implies the alteration of environments for the optimization of the life existing within them. Population thus also registers the governmental commitment to producing healthy, happy, and vigorous, that is, productive, life through improvements to the socio-natural milieu. As we shall see, a powerful argument for developing a biopolitical reading of art's adoption by governmental and market forces is the way it helps to create optimal milieus for improving life, producing a more than just living, the provision of public culture and the acculturation of public space must therefore be examined for correspondences with the normative, economic, productive, behavioral, and medical agendas of neoliberalism. Within modern democracies, and especially their neoliberal moment, culture becomes a way to build associations among populations fragmented by capitalism's systemic production of divisions of class, race, gender, sexuality, occupation, time, and geography. And I think that's interesting that, culture is it's pinioned as something that it can go against capitalism, but it's always also co-opted back into it. But here it's also the only thing that we can use to defend ourselves with. So hence a constant evolution, I guess. It also provides a means through which the individualistic and competitive metric of human capital can be inflated. Happy citizens are those whose cultural self-development makes them more successful, producing higher self-esteem, health, social value, earning capacity, and also happiness, not to mention tax contributions. This tautological yet deeply effective logic of social interpolation and conformity converts culture into an indispensable dispositif of post-Fordist government. If the primary object of policing, according to Foucault, is to promote men's coexistence with each other, what? Then we cannot underestimate culture's own police function. Yet within capitalism, I guess we come together against the police. Yet within capitalism, the networks of cultural association are always belied by the imperatives of individualism and the self-appreciation of human capital. Alienation. Art satisfies these conflicting demands by gathering audiences while maintaining itself as their principal point of association. Like the infants in Donald Winnicott's psychoanalytic theory of play art, audiences are together alone, yet now in the presence of a shared and external fantasy. This condition of association by which the artwork's meaning occupies the event's horizon helps to explain how contemporary art, especially its participatory form, provides power with the means to foster active association without the dangers of unscripted proximity and collaboration. This is the social insurance policy of autonomous art that guarantees its official popularity. If meaning is the inescapable shibboleth of art, then economic growth is the inescapable meaning of biopower's action upon the body of the population. The autonomy of life that both art and power court must never fully rupture the systems of value and meaning they are assimilated to. That, I don't know why, but we'll see. I'm not trying to be a sovereign citizen or anything, but we'll see. This tension between contingency and meaning also haunts philosophies of life and theories of evolution. But while sharing many of the same coordinates as life, philosophy, and vitalist thought, epitomized in Nietzsche and Bergson, biopolitical theory by and large skirts the subject of life science, not to mention any overt engagement with the long history of philosophy's treatment of nature. If theorists of biopower are undeniably right to see the importance of life's discovery as an autonomous entity for the development of biopolitical control, what seems to be missing is a historical construction of how this development connects to the simultaneous emergence of evolutionary theory, and indeed how this relates to wider philosophies of life. Although this book cannot mount a satisfactory engagement with this formidable subject, it will begin the essential work of relating the open plan of life, as we might call it, that emerges through the Enlightenment, to political and aesthetic turns to life. We can think about this overlap between life science, art, and biopower in terms of the dialectic of amorphousness and semblance that Adorno finds in art. This antinomy corresponds to conflicting models of life emerging within life science and the life philosophies it feeds. Thus, with the Enlightenment, we see the advent of a battle between contingent and meaningful models of organismic life and its genesis that has lasted to this day and has tended to erupt at significant points throughout modern history. Although conflicting models can ultimately be connected to ancient debates around the behavior of progenitive matter and its relationship to the idea in Plato and Aristotle that eventually gave rise to the somatic bias of metaphysical philosophy, we can also relate their recurrence in modern debates over phylogenesis and ontogenesis in modern biopolitical developments. For instance, we can observe that early debates around the concept of entelechy, the notion that life carries within itself its own autonomous purpose, that was developed through laboratory science in Germany and France in the late 18th century, heat up with capitalism's creation of a proletariat that unleashed hitherto unknown levels of discipline, comprehension, compression, exploitation, and control of bodies. Theories of life's autonomy coincide with the inordinate refinement of mechanisms for controlling it. Central to these biological debates was the question of whether life could be said to carry out its own autonomous plan. The theory of preformationism, or conversely, whether its genesis could be understood as a series of physiochemical effects acting between the genome and its environment, so-called epigenesis. The separation of life from divine purpose that inaugurates the biopolitical age sees it thrown alongside art into the capitalist theater of contingency and control. An effect of this is the advent of Leibniz's philosophie in the latter part of the 19th century, in which questions of freedom and human potential are referred to the dynamics of our biological substrate, most conspicuously in the work of Nietzsche and Bergson. These were explicitly influenced by Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species and his powerful theorization of life's emergent dynamics. And of course, I know probably everyone is thinking these thinkers have been co-opted by, you know, the dark enlightenment or whatever, and a lot of it has gone south, but, you know, don't worry. Don't worry, we're not going down that path. In Nietzsche's biological theory of the will to power, which voids the prospect of resolution as any imaginable teleos of politics as much as in Bergson's notion of the elan vital, that conversely claims that the maximization of freedom inheres within life's own development, we can see evolutionary theory being turned into antithetical ends. Life is nihilistically construed as the chance effect of an underlying contingency, or its intensifier, the will to power, on the one hand, or as the idealist or spiritual coherence of matter, organism, and reason, on the other. While life as naturally occurring system of organization becomes a more overt reference for politics, art, science, and power, it is accompanied by a ranging debate over the meaningful coherence, spirituality, superiority, or utter chance of organic life. Today, these debates continue to play out in neo-Darwinist disagreements over adaptation and whether it can be understood as producing the organism's optimum fitness within a given environment, or whether, in fact, species evolution defies any such utilitarian correlation of parts and functions, instead combining multiple adaptive forces and effects not legible in terms of their current use. As evolutionary biologist and historian of science Stephen Jay Gould has argued, if the nose was not designed to support spectacles or the leg support breeches, then to understand biological mutation means distinguishing current use from origination. Such a distinction, contra neo-Darwinists who tend to reduce all of adaptation to natural selection based on fitness, opens up the prospect of the non-linearity of phylogenesis that does not necessarily optimize fitness according to environment, but operates according to integrated bas plane, or innate structures or ground planes, irreducible to utility. It is worth noting that despite the increasing complexity of scientific models of life, the ambitions of biological utilitarianism seem to grow in direct proportion to the molecularization of its field of action, as evidenced by the highly capitalized biotech industry. The mapping of the genome is a case in point, sparking the great hope that man had finally unlocked the code of codes and would therefore be able to write nature's next chapter, until it was established that the discounted junk DNA is indeed an essential, if impossibly non-linear, determinant of gene expression. This book argues that the dialectic of amorphousness and semblance, or indeterminacy and determination, which drives the development of modern art, also animates theories of life and the politics of biopower. Just as modern art, wanting to capture free appearance in its ambit, cannot help but convert this into meaning, in the end, it is this something and not that other thing. Life forms act as surfaces upon which the chaos of emergence can be registered, while at the same time their facticity being such that it is that it always matters, is always productive of meaning. Thinking life beyond the man form is, in this sense, continuously performed by empirical science as it reveals the horizonlessness of life's development. Conversely, while organisms inhere absolutely within the conditions from which they arise, and while those conditions can be non-definitively formulated as laws, life does not reveal its predicates in any comprehensively plaudable way. In this respect, life, science, and art unite the darkness of the intangible with the illumination of the concept. And I think this is interesting in regards to the last meeting of constructing the real, because we were talking about the job of the artist in contemporary society as being a person who must consider how to illustrate and make visible the invisible, especially in terms of the way that our societies are being plagued by environmental collapse and our understanding of pandemic. This open plan connects very interestingly to what Rensselaer calls the dissensual practice of politics within biopower. For Rensselaer, it is not simply the case, as it is for Arendt and Agamben, that the declaration of the rights of man and citizens falsely founds rights within the bodily life of a fictitious universal subject, since contrary to what these rights claim, they are neither guaranteed by the simple fact of being born nor by citizenship, a danger revealed by the plight of refugees. Against this conception of the false logic of rights, Rensselaer argues that the space of rights carved out by law, whose subject is indeed non-existent, is there to be filled out by our demands. The Declaration of Rights acts as a placeholder that can be filled with the content it de facto excludes. He gives the example of how during the French Revolution, a female activist called Olympe de Gouges protested that if women could be sent to the scaffold, they should be admitted to the assembly. In doing this, she exposed the impossibility of drawing a border between bare life, zoe, and political life, bios. For if the death penalty is brought to bear on all bodies equally, and thus all bodies are politicized at this one point, then this equality that founds the Declaration of Rights should admit all life equally into the realm of politics. Or, put another way, all life is political. It is worth quoting Rensselaer at length. Women acted as subjects of the rights of man in the precise sense that I have mentioned. They acted as subjects that did not have the rights that they had, and that had the rights that they had not. This is what I call a dissensus. The putting of two worlds in one and the same world. The question of the political subject is not caught between the void term of man and the plenitude of the citizen with its actual rights. A political subject is a capacity for staging scenes of dissensus. The very difference between man and citizen is not a sign of disjunction, proving that rights are either void or tautological. It is the opening of an interval or political subjectivation. Art and Bare Life proposes that the interval that allows for political subjectivation to be connected to the undecidability of biological life's horizon is defining capacity for error and errancy in Foucault's account, as well as to the moving border between art and non-art, because
It is only in these discontinuities that all being and beings become. Desensus transforms the subject, or being, by incorporating what is hostile to it, while it reciprocally forms what resists being formed or is antithetical to it. By combining the antonyms of dissonance and consensus into the concept of the political subject, Desensus expresses how amorphousness and meaning combine into the very motor of politics and art. This dynamic provides a social analog to the way organic evolution is wrestled out of its struggle with inert matter. Bergson summarizes the creative struggle in the following way. In reality, life is a movement. Materiality is the inverse movement. And each of these two movements is simple. The matter which forms a world being an undivided flux. And undivided also the life that runs through it. Cutting out in it living beings all along its track. Of these two currents, the second runs counter to the first, but the first obtains all the same, something from the second. There results between them a modus vivendi, which is organization. In what follows, I will diagram the modus vivendi that emerges through the analogous intersection of art and power that is driven by their mutual pursuit of life. As with Bergson's action of matter upon the countervailing current of life, power looks to control and form contingent emergence, whether political, economic, biological, or cultural. Yet biopower never fully achieves the submission of those opposing currents to its forms, not simply because they resist, but also because the total imposition of its structure would kill the very archkinesos it feeds on. Desensus is a very apt way to think about politics and art within biopower because it mirrors the emergence of life as an effect of environmental constraints. The becoming unleashed by these conflicting currents is the basis of political subjectification and the self-negating movement of art, as well as the emergence of the very life that is at stake in both systems. Not only does this provide us with a non-dichotomous model of the interaction between biology and culture, but it also provides a clue as to the new continues to appear in the absence of any utopian orientation to the future. If that power to generate the new is of special interest to biopower, the desensus through which it always arrives acts as a perennial challenge to its conversion of life into the dead form of value. Thus concludes the introduction to Josephine Barry's book, Art and Bare Life. And I think it's dope as hell because they're, you know, we're leaving on a high note saying, you know, the power of making something new is independent of capitalism. So all we have to do is fucking kick the shit out of the system, and we've got a wide open moment to do that, and we should keep making art throughout the whole thing, and maybe hopefully see you for some cool talk in the Discord, because you know, we're going to be posting snippets of text and, you know, contextualization of this, writing, and also, you know, any definitions of terminology if people had trouble understanding what was being read, in our Art and Labor Discord. So hope to see you in Constructing the Real Art and Labor Discord. You can sign up on our Patreon to gain access, but you can also just write us a letter if you want to join and you don't have money to do so. Because we think that learning and just talking shit is way more important than spending money. So, hope to see you all online and in real life. And hope you all stay alive and let's have fun. I care if you have an aeroplane that can fly the world and we can have a fantasy. It doesn't matter if you drive a limousine. It really doesn't matter if you drive for galaxy. I really don't care if you destroy. Let's have fun, lots of fun.